Hello.
Oh my gosh, I'm very excited because this is my first official recording with fancy mics.
Wow, the setup is so profesh too. They really are the fancy mics. This is like a full-ass recording studio.
Ronnie's being very nice because she just sat through like 25 minutes of me watching a YouTube video and figuring out exactly how to configure this whole thing.
But you did it. This is Women in STEM. This is audio programming. You figured it out. You are audio production and producing. What can't you do?
Okay, we love to see it. So, actually, Ronnie was the person who introduced me to this book and to Mass Lib's pro-Black liberation / unpacking anti-Blackness within Latinidad book club. And we read Inventing Latinos by Laura Gomez. I guess I can start at the top by giving a little summary, if that would help, and then you can add on whatever you want. This book interrogates the how and why of Latinx identity formation in the U.S., breaking down this perhaps already known quote from Stuart Hall, "We are here because you were there." The history of the U.S. propping up dictators in Latin America, quashing leftist rebellions and movements, colonizing Puerto Rico, and how all of that has led to intense Latinx migration to the U.S. The book talks about how racial conventions make some people's race less malleable than others. So that's where the discussions of anti-Blackness come in, where Latinidad is playing this sort of strange buffer in between race and between white folks and Black folks in the U.S. and the history of that. She importantly talks about how Latinxes have navigated that racial space and oftentimes on the back of Black Americans. She does a geographic overview of Mexico, Central America, and the Caribbean, and talks about the racial formations there, plus the differing U.S. immigration policies. These are the different countries I just mentioned, and how that's impacted differential power and social capital for some ethnic Latinx groups over others. Ronnie, is there anything you'd like to add?
That was so perfect. Thank you so much for that context. And I think another really important component Laura touched on was U.S. intervention creates conditions that favor migration to the United States due to its economic power in the region, its depletion of labor opportunities in Latin America, and the pool of low-wage work in the United States, particularly in the industrial and agricultural sectors. But we'll talk more about that, I'm sure.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Ronnie. So something I really appreciated about the book is the "we are here because you were there" analysis. The U.S. engages in imperialism, overthrowing socialist candidates in Latin America, and then systematically denies the people fleeing those regimes asylum. Do you agree with her suggestion that the U.S. think of opening its borders as a form of reparations for its imperialist actions abroad?
Yeah, I do. I think that's what I had just started to touch on, in the way it's like we kind of owe this to these countries, to these people, these communities. Just historically, the U.S.'s imperialist presence and disruption within Central America has been so profound and extractive.
Definitely. I think I appreciated that too, considering so much of the U.S. discourse is like, go back to your country.
Right.
Why are you here? And it's like, we are here because you were there. That is the answer to that question.
That's what it was. I also really loved how in this chapter it laid the historical context of how, going back to FDR's 1936 promise to be a good neighbor to Latin American countries, and like what that actually meant.
Yeah.
When then later on the United Fruit Company, which was really extractive and a major player in this story, especially in Honduras and Guatemala,
yeah,
you know, led to American military intervention, and it was justified in order to protect American corporate interests. And unfortunately, we still see that today, but I think that that context is really, really important.
I think it is too, and it connects to a lot of more recent contemporary environmental defense campaigns and fights that we're seeing in Central America, because it's literally the same dynamic of large oil companies, large electricity companies who have privatized basic social goods and continue to reap a profit off of the backs of very humble people who don't have access to their basic needs and therefore need to migrate to the US.
Yeah.
So I wanted to talk about the 1980 Refugee Act because it was actually instructive for me. Now the US adjudicates asylum applications individually. So it will look at an individual person's case and decide, were you persecuted on the basis of race, national origin, religion, political opinion, your queerness, etc., and we'll give you asylum on that basis. Whereas before, they would, kind of similar to TPS actually, they would just designate asylum for whole countries of people, and they could just, right.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah, they would determine the political situation in a country and say, oh, this country's government is so destabilized that anybody from that country can get asylum. And it was in the 1980 Refugee Act that they changed that and changed it to individual determinations, which is how we get to this place now where everyone's talking about this backlog of immigration cases. And it's true. I mean, asylum cases take like 5, 6, 7 years to adjudicate. But like, let's not lose sight of the fact that that's actually a manufactured backlog, that the U.S. has the ability to grant widespread amnesty and has done so already in the past, like with NACARA, Reagan did that. And, you know, this idea that we need to pump so much money into a huge government agency with so many judges and so many asylum officials and so many bureaucrats is actually just wrong.
It's just feeding its own system.
Yeah, definitely. Mm. And totally bought into this idea that government services are always going to be harmful. But I think with this, it's very apparent how the bloat of government isn't really helping us.
Yeah.
It's important to imagine solutions outside of just funding DHS more, which is so much of the recommendations that I hear, because Congress has the ability to pass widespread amnesty for people. And we already know who deserves it. We just need to look at the U.S. imperialist history.
Right. This book, when we were reading and talking about colonialism and immigration as part of the same continuum, the author brought up, in the case of the 5 Central American nations where the United States has been the most recently active in supporting brutal military dictatorships, it is especially compelling to treat migrants from these countries as rightfully in the United States, such as by collective grant of refugee status. And then she talked about the United Nations in 81 declaring all Salvadorans who left their country should be considered bona fide refugees under its definition as persons who have fled their country because their lives, safety, or liberty have been threatened by a generalized violence, and on. But the United States defines refugees much more narrowly now, and it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, and that's actually one of the hardest things about asylum to explain to folks when I was working at the Florence Project and doing Know Your Rights presentations. I was like, are you afraid of persecution in your home country? They're like, definitely.
Right.
And I'm like, no, but you have to have specific evidence, like police reports, photographs, declarations that testify to how you in particular were targeted. Whereas the first program that you described is much more generous. It's just sort of like looking at the geopolitical situation being like, as a whole, we determine this country is unstable. And so if you come here, it's assumed that you have a good asylum or refugee case.
It's
so different from how it is now.
I really resent that because to me, that sounds like qualify your extreme conditions. Like, prove to us that it is really that bad. Can't just be like, yes, it's bad. I need to be here. Nobody wants to freaking leave their home. Nobody wants to make that hard, hard journey. Like, once they've gotten there and they're like, are you sure? Like, yes, I'm freaking sure. And maybe I don't have the ability to give all these evidence or document because had to go.
I know. I hate that part of the system too. And that's why actually it creates this perverse incentive where the strongest asylum cases are the ones where there's been the most horrific fucked up trauma. And that's why if you overhear a conversation between immigration asylum lawyers, they'll be like, oh my God, this person was tortured by the state agent. That's amazing. And it's like, it's fucking sick. And
but yeah. Like it will hold up well in court and on their case.
But it's just nice to know this other system existed where like we just kind of treated people more humanely and didn't require them to divulge the nastiest, most horrific things that have ever happened to them to these strangers that they just met.
Yeah.
The reason also I wanted to bring this up is after that change in the law that happened in 1980, and then the Salvadoran Civil War emerged prior to 1980, but was kicking up in the 80s. And that's when folks started to flee. That's when my parents left the country. And less than 3% of Salvadorans who sought asylum in the U.S. received it.
Wow.
And so it kind of becomes apparent this change in the asylum system really was about ultimately just limiting the number of brown people that could enter the country.
Yeah.
It's not that complicated. You know, we can let large numbers of people in. We've done it before.
I was just thinking that is such blatant anti-blackness in our laws of like who we're making it easy to migrate for. Who are we opening our doors for, and who are we making it really difficult for people to get through?
No, yeah. And I think a more contemporary example that we can have of this that is useful to look at and think about for this is the treatment of Haitian migrants in Del Rio versus Ukrainians. You can see how easily the government can move when it's for white people, when it's for white asylum seekers and refugees. And the situation with Haiti has been one where we've continually been receiving immigrants and have treated them most terribly of all migrants. There's an undeniable anti-blackness about the U.S. immigration system in that it detains, deports, arrests more black immigrants than any other racial subgroup, even though they make up a minority, actually, of immigrants.
Right. And then even thinking about the U.S.'s role and presence in Haiti. The U.S. invaded Haiti and the Dominican Republic in 1915 and 1916. And Marines occupied the DR for 8 years, but they stayed twice as long until 1934 in Haiti. That led to an enduring perception of racial superiority over Haiti in the DR that has been propagated for centuries, and Dominicans' insistence that they have less African ancestry than Haitians, as well as Spanish and indigenous ancestry, which is not possessed by Haitians, which is obviously a very racist narrative that reinforces their complexion as being one of Indio.
Or just black.
As opposed to being... Wait, pardon? Say that again.
Oh, I was going to say the construction is that Haitians are black and that Dominicans are indigenous.
Yes.
Even though it's literally the same island!
Yeah. Don't let the Spanish colonize your mind. It's so silly. Yeah, right. Absolutely.
And the other thing I'll say about Haiti. So another lit review book that I did was The Borders of Dominicanidad, where Professor Lorgia Garcia Peña is sort of advocating for a re-understanding of Latinidad as emerging with the rebellion and revolution in Haiti.
Wow.
Yeah. And then it actually like makes so much sense historically because Haiti did inspire so many independence movements across like other parts of Latin America. It was the first independent black state in the Americas. And the reasons for excluding Haitians in that community from Latinidad are very arbitrary. And then when it really boils down to it, it's just anti-black.
Yep. There it is.
Because every time. Like, let's be fucking honest. We're not closer in any sort of way to Spain than France.
No.
You know, these are sort of like very arbitrary unifiers that have been imposed on us and that some of us have perpetuated as well, really don't make a lot of sense for like from like an organizing perspective. But if you think about Latinx as a political identity, then actually it makes complete sense for the Haitian Revolution to be the start of that identity.
That's beautiful. I think I love that perspective.
Shout out Lorgia Garcia Peña. Harvard did her dirty. They denied her tenure, but she's flourishing anyway.
Yeah, we don't need it. Academia to qualify us.
Exactly, to validate us.
You're right.
breaks down that 7 out of 10 Mexican Americans in the U.S. trace their roots to Mexicans living in the half of Mexico that the U.S. invaded and conquered in the 19th century, and then finalized and formalized through the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. Mm-hmm. 2/3 of these Mexicans lived in what is now New Mexico, and actually the rest of that territory, including Arizona, was unceded Indian territory where indigenous peoples fought off both Spanish colonial rule and mm-hmm. then Mexican incorporation as citizens.
Yeah.
Were you aware of the strength and longevity of indigenous resistance in Arizona and how indigenous folks fought off two forms of colonial rule here?
Yes, and specifically here in Tucson as well. So originally Arizona, before Arizona received statehood in 1912, when this territory was acquired by, after the Gadsden Purchase.
It was after the Treaty of Guadalupe.
No, so that was, that came later, right? That was the treaty after the...
Tucson was incorporated later, though.
Right, exactly. Okay, so I believe after the Gadsden Purchase, I'm like 80% sure it was the Gadsden Purchase, whatever. And it was just northern Arizona, what is now Arizona. But this was still considered, like, Tucson area, southern Arizona, was a part of Mexico. And it wasn't until after the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo when the United States decided that they would use the river as the border, as the determining factor, and then acquired southern Arizona. But Tucson actually resisted Anglo-dominant population until like 1936, long after it acquired statehood. And I think we still feel that resistance here alive today.
For sure. And I think it's important to say that there's like a number of types of governance happening here, because there's indigenous folks with their reservations, and then there, like, Tucson itself was founded by Mexicans, and then there was this warring between them that you're talking about, like this sort of constant potential of like an Anglo takeover, which is kind of funny because they're always talking about it the other way, when actually, like, how it happened was a total, like, whitewashing of the Mexican history and culture of Tucson. But sure, we're the invaders.
Yeah.
Sure.
Whatever. We got to do the Western thing and have a rodeo to attract more.
Or not have like a hotel called El Conquistador.
Oh my gosh. Just stayed there this weekend.
Well, that was something I wanted to bring up too, because that's some... Oh, wait. Now I'm talking about La Calle.
Oh my gosh, too many great books. Hold on. We're resisting colonialism. Long history here.
Yes. Okay, let's get back on track. So, the federal government only began counting Latinos in 1980. What interest did the government have in tracking Latinxes?
I think that is, like, ultimately, like, control, right? Like, mm-hmm. keeping eyes on not only, like, migration, but policing those communities, like, the creation of the Border Patrol. Oh, that's coming later. And hold on, I lost my... I was going to say something good and then lost my train of thought. Cut this part out.
Yeah.
Hold on. I want to find something good to say. When we're counting Latinos, we still in thinking about how the broader Latino identity has sometimes offered escape from specific disadvantages. Oh, wait, hold on. I'm talking about federal government.
So I think what I want to bring up in the conversation is just the long history of Latinxes being surveilled by the U.S. government, and also this narrative of hordes and an invasion of Latinxes as justification for immigration enforcement. Because the U.S. Immigration Bureau claimed in 1911 that 50,000 Mexicans crossed the border every year without permission. And that was what led to the creation of Border Patrol in 1924. What we were talking about a little bit earlier is off recording, is that where did that 50,000 number even come from?
Yeah, on the media, when someone just says this large number of migrants crossed today, it's just like, it feels like scare tactics, media scare tactics that
but
reinforce.
But this is like a government official that's, you know, this is like the U.S. Immigration Bureau that said this. And I just bring that up.
I stand by what I said. Feels like fear tactics.
Well, I'm bringing that up because it's important to recognize the history of U.S. government officials.
Yes.
I brought up Korematsu and the internment of Japanese people during World War II and how the Supreme Court allowed that to happen in part because the U.S. Solicitor General made up this evidence about how there was a ton of subterfuge Japanese spying happening on the part of Japanese American citizens, and the truth was that that was actually not the case at all. Those numbers were fabricated, and it was only after the fact that that came out. It was like a really, really long time after that the government apologized for that and like recognized that happened. And I think Obama might have been the one that recognized it, which is just, like, really rich. Because talking about treatment of people of color, then there's going to be an uncovering of what they said and did to justify their border policies later on, too. But, important.
Yeah.
So, speaking of World War II, I wanted to bring up how that was sort of a turning point for Latinx professionals and advocates, where there was a visible shift in strategy away from arguing that Latinxes are white. And wanted to ask if you could unpack why it is that happened.
Yeah, so after World War II ended, basically U.S. imperialism in Latin America was justified by anti-communism and the Cold War, the Cuban Revolution of 1959 and the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1961 drove American opposition to pro-labor governments and support for authoritarian dictators in virtually every Central American nation. And then we have these covert CIA-led operations to depose and install governments that characterized American intervention in Central America. And then later on, so rather than direct military intervention, American control shifted to a combination of covert intelligence and then U.S. military training of local armies, national police, and foreign aid for drug interdiction, military weapons, and, you know, border patrol.
Yeah.
Strengthening that police force.
And I feel like the U.S., especially post-World War II, during the Cold War, was postulating itself as a defender of human rights. So it was a pretty bad look that the U.S. had Jim Crow segregation.
Doesn't look good, guys. Turn inward. Oh, my gosh.
And I think because who we're talking about is like the old guard, like LULAC, who were really tethered to this idea that Latinxes could be white and that arguing in the court that they are white and trying to get rights for them as a community in that way was the prior strategy. And I see these historical developments as elucidating for groups like that it just is not smart to advocate that you're white, because at the end of the day, you're not going to receive the same treatment that white people do. as just a brief example, there was the school desegregation cases in Texas where Mexican Americans were segregated in the same schools as Black students. And instead of arguing for integration for both of those racial groups, what groups like LULAC did is that they instead tried to argue that Mexicans were white and so they should be put in the white school instead of the Black school. And I think also the treatment of veterans when they returned from World War II, I'm sure led to like a racial consciousness that sort of made it so that the arguing that that Latinxs are white just became obsolete.
Yeah. Unfortunately.
Fortunately.
Fortunately.
Strategy didn't work, Ronnie. We'll edit that out, don't worry.
Oh my gosh. Silly. Fortunately.
Oh, well, that was something that I put in the notes, is that the way that veterans were discriminated against was really nasty. Like, when they returned home to Texas, like, you know, if somebody had died and their body was returned, funeral homes and cemeteries refused to bury them in the white cemeteries.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So that's what I'm saying. It's just sort of like upfront realness. You sacrificed your life for this country.
It's supposed to be the ultimate patriot. They still disrespected
you at the ultimate hour. And I think that's like that created a consciousness amongst people.
You can do the American thing and lay down your life, and still they will not see you, even in your death as a quote-unquote patriot, as being worthy be buried with their white people.
Yeah.
It's gross. Right.
No, it's like so deeply disrespectful when you think about how this person gave their life for this nation state.
Yeah, and was convinced still, like, to.
White citizens didn't want them buried next to them in the cemetery. It's just like, how do you even come up with that level of hate?
It sounds very American to me.
Sounds super Caucasian.
Yeah, it's a white people thing. It's on brand.
And I actually think that this is a good segue to talking about why Latinxes have a lot to learn from the Black community about the limitations of U.S. citizenship. That post-World War II consciousness was happening for Black folks too, because they were denied the benefits that white veterans were given in terms of the GI Bill and subsidized mortgages and subsidized college education. And I think with newer waves of migrants from Latin America or the global South more generally, there's this idea and investment in U.S. citizenship. Like, even in the work that I do, I'm trying to get people permanent residency and citizenship. And so there's this idea that when we get there, our lives will be better. And I cannot, as a U.S. citizen, minimize legal status and what that means and being able to stay united with families. And also have to say that I've been treated like a second-class citizen my whole life in this country. And that is what I think we have to learn from Black communities, because they know this already. Like, they fought for this idea of expansive citizenship with the 14th Amendment, and they already live the limitations of it every day. So I think, you know, that's why I want to invest in spaces like the MassLib, Black Liberation / Unpacking Latinx Anti-Blackness Book Club.
It's a mouthful.
It's a good time. We're workshopping the name.
Yeah. Stay tuned.
Well, so in the 1930s, as many as 2 million people, so this is during the Bracero Program era, as many as 2 million people, many of whom were U.S. citizens, were deported to Mexico. And that's sort of like something important to note too, like there are examples within the Black community, and then also, like, there are literally examples in Latinx people's own history of U.S. citizenship not being enough to protect you.
Right.
Like, they, for internment, for deportation of Bracero program workers, like, there were thousands of U.S. citizens who were deported or who were interned during those efforts, and it didn't really matter, did it, that they were considered citizens. So now I wanted to discuss a favorite topic of yours, the myth of mestizaje.
Oh my God. It's so silly.
So I wanted to have you explain to folks, what is the myth of mestizaje, and how did that play out in the DR? We sort of touched on that a little
bit. Yeah, we did. We're kind of jumping around a little bit.
Yeah.
But essentially, like, we were even talking about this the other day with La Malinche.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, okay, so the myth of mestizaje is that it was consensual at all, essentially.
Yeah.
First,
that there was a, quote, creation of a new race, and then two, that it was that occurred via consensual means.
Right. The reality is that white, mainly men, colonizers came and raped indigenous women and their children, their offspring, who had white features, those Spanish features, were granted certain privileges in society at large, within colonized society. And so the shame was then replaced by upward social mobility, which led to this sort of idea of, like, blanqueamiento, la raza, and whitening the race, and as posing that as something to reach for. Mexico established this caste system.
A lot of countries did.
Okay.
Yeah, but Mexico had, I don't know, they have, like, a very intricate chart.
Right, okay, so that's what I'm imagining in my head, is that little diagram.
I think a lot of folks have seen
it's like
it
a painting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And we talked about it in the book club. Shout out, Matt.
Right.
We did. And it's really the best way I can kind of describe it for our listeners here is that it's sort of set up, like, with every combination of, oh, it's so gross, of, like, parentage.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, if there was to be a...
It's like a very crude, like, biology XY chromosome.
Yeah.
Do you remember doing those where...
Yeah, in science, where you had to, like, roll the dice. So that...
Yeah.
You get all these phenotypes.
By the way... maybe that brought up for you and your family a lot of aspirations for whiteness, because we had a lot of ancestors allegedly with light features and a lot of people with darker features in the family, which just led me to wonder, like, not wonder but conclude, somebody's lying,
right?
Because they taught me that this is a dominant trait and this is a recessive trait, and we can't have this many recessive traits.
Look at me, Yvette.
right.
I am very dark skinned. I have dark hair, and my whole life, my sisters are fairer than I am. My mom is also dark-skinned, but both of her parents are very fair. My grandmother, her mom, being fair with dark jet black hair, and then her father, who was always bragged about having Spanish ancestry, because my grandfather is, like, light brown hair with green eyes and fair skinned. And so there was always, there's always, like, this, you know, allegedly we have these Spanish ancestors because he has green eyes, but I mean, he's the only one. And It's so silly. What does that mean for us? Why is that something you have to just kind of give as a disclaimer? Like, oh yeah, this is why. Because again, that's that reach for like higher status. It's like, oh, you're a level up in this kind of caste system. Not kind of, it is a caste system.
Yeah, that's what exists now has existed is this caste system based on phenotype and all these sort of Eurocentric things like Catholicism, being able to speak Spanish as a language, mm-hmm. are ways that people can gain socioeconomic mobility on top of like the phenotypical stuff. And so, yeah, that's why there's just like a complicated ass chart. I think it feels complicated, especially as someone who grew up in the US, where sort of more clear cut who's white and who isn't. But
yeah.
One country that the left ignores regarding anti-blackness is Cuba. Mm-hmm. Even though black people were necessary for defeating Spain and achieving independence, anti-black policies and practices persisted throughout post-independence. How can non-black Latinxes show solidarity to black Cubans that have survived this and continue living under that oppressive regime?
Standing with them,
mm-hmm.
as a starting point, refusing colorism within Latinidad and not reinforcing any problematic anti-black ways of moving mm-hmm. through the world and within our communities and families. Yeah.
Totally. I feel like it's important to recognize the U.S. role of incentivizing anti-blackness within the Cuban government and incentivizing the Cuban government to disenfranchise Afro-Cubans more generally. Right. In 1912, as an example, the U.S. threatened a military invasion of Cuba if they didn't suppress the Afro-Cuban political movement known and organized around as the Partido Independiente de Color. Mm. And they said, quote, "We don't want another Haiti."
Jeez.
So, again, Haiti comes up, I think.
Which to me says we don't want more black people. Yeah. That's what I hear.
Well, I also hear I don't want more black and brown people governing themselves.
Mm.
Because that's what makes Haiti and its revolution so scary to the U.S. and to France, is that it was the first independent state, the first independent black nation state in the Americas in the context of transatlantic slavery. That's, you know, Haiti was like risking so many fucked up slave owners' livelihoods.
Right. Which is American interests, mm-hmm. was American interests. Because it was American corporations who put that pressure on the government to threaten that military invasion if Cuba didn't suppress their people.
Mm-hmm.
And they responded by arresting 200 members of the 60,000-strong political party. Days of protests went on, and in the end, the Cuban government was slaughtered 40,000 party members and largely continues to deny the reality of anti-black racism.
Mm-hmm. So to conclude this episode, I wanted to move into this direction of questions. Is it possible to save Latinidad without perpetuating mestizaje?
I think that it can be. I think that identifying as Latino ultimately means identifying as either indigenous or black, and maybe perhaps not even needing to separate the two, mm-hmm. because the two are so closely linked and connected in all ways within with across our cultures due to colonialism. But I also think that the way Latinidad exists now is problematic in the way that it is so closely related to white as a race. And we still see that within our families. And like I said before, like La Raza, and like even in just, yeah, just the ways that Latinos reach for whiteness within their own communities and reject anti-Indigenous and reject indigeneity and Blackness.
I think it's only worth investing in Latinidad as an organizing tool, as like a political organizing tool, because we have all these countries with distinct histories, and at the same time we come to the U.S. and we're treated similarly in many ways, even if like if we come from the DR or from Mexico or from El Salvador. And I think the chapter on the census shows that because it talks about how when Latinx as a race wasn't included in the census, there was 37% to 43% of Latinxes who identified as other.
Right. Still and, opting to not be white, you know, yes. That is not.
Or just sort of like accepting the reality of their experience. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like they're sort and I feel that way too. It's just like, I understand that I'm light skinned and that in Latin American context, I would have a lot of privilege. In the U.S., I'm not read as white, and I'm not going to check that as a box because I have not lived my life as a white woman in the U.S.
Right.
And so, and, like, that is an experience to organize around. Like, that hurts, and that's what needs to change, and that's why we organize together.
I think specifically in Arizona, like when we have such harmful policies, like, or historically we have such harmful policies specifically targeting Latinidad and Latino communities, such as SB 1070, you know, a lot of our organizing, our communities began organizing out of necessity in response to that very targeted law, and led to the creation of, you know, ultimately what turned our very conservative state purple, quote unquote. But like that was communities of Latino communities organized.
Exactly.
So that makes sense.
Yeah. That's how I see it. Because I mean, as a Salvadoran, I get annoyed, at the erasure of Central American history.
Right. We're not all Mexican.
Yes, exactly. And it's like, and I recognize, you know, a lot of people are like, our histories are different. I'm like, I understand. It's like they're different. And then we organize around how our, well, but it's like, it's organizing around how our communal experiences in common, and also showing solidarity for our experiences that are different. I think that's what makes it strong, because otherwise, then I think Latinidad as a project just becomes like anti-Black and anti-Indigenous. So it has to be like that component of like organizing around your own mistreatment as like this identity, Latinx, and then also being in solidarity with the most marginalized people within that group, which are Black Latinxes and Indigenous folks. Some of whom may also identify as Latinx.
It's the decolonization of Latinidad that we're interested in.
Yes.
Is what I'm hearing.
Yes.
Reconnecting. Mm-hmm. Let's connect on the differences between the ways our culture and our communities were affected by colonialism, and also they're not that different. It's still, it was all extractive, and unfortunately that is what unites us. But
it's, and from there we can gather strength, indignation for a better future.
Yes. Exactly.
Yes.
Like a little stardust.
How can Latinx nexus move away from a politics of incorporation to a politics of fugitivity, as Fred Moten says. So that's taking from the Black radical tradition, which thinks about how to be a fugitive for liberation, not how to become the perfect citizen, not how to incorporate ourselves as the perfect U.S. citizen, but instead, how do we embrace fugitivity?
I love that. Right? That is beautiful. Right? And it's just like, we're all on the run. We're all being targeted by America. And when I say we
not we all.
I'm talking about Latina.
Okay.
And not really, but specifically migrant communities who are facing persecution.
Yeah. For migration.
And if they don't have protected status and like what that means as being a fugitive and also disconnected from homeland and trying to settle, but inability to. That's, God, it really sucks here.
It's fucking powerful, right?
That's beautiful, but like heartbreaking in a beautiful way. I love that comparison. It illustrates it well to me.
Yeah. I take a lot of inspiration from the Black radical tradition and like Fred Moten's discussion of like Marunage and like Maroon communities, like escaped, like folks who were enslaved who escaped to otherwise uninhabitable, like swampy, like boggy areas and like stayed there because they were so difficult for other people to reach and were kind of hard to live on, but like that's how they thrived. That's what I see as like an archetypal type of fugitivity. Like, how do we create strong communities outside of government surveillance that persist and that thrive?
I want to build them.
Yeah.
Let's do it. They don't exist yet, but do exist, right? No, I'm sorry. That's what we were just talking about, like specifically in like, I'm thinking about New Orleans, right? And the Zapatistas in Oaxaca, all across, there's resistance, Palestinian resistance, like let's go. I'm so sorry. Resistance exists all across the globe and I know that and celebrate that, but I want to build those specific resilient communities that don't rely on harmful state, the extractive state. But yeah, not to minimize the really intense surveillance that specifically we face here and migrants face in the Southwest.
Yes, completely. So the last question I'm asking folks on this season is, what is something that has been inspiring you lately?
Honestly, Tucson community, my neighbors, the way that so many mutual aid organizations cohesively connect and step up to bridge the failures in our cities, in our cities, in our counties, and do so in a way that centers collective healing and really bringing folks what they need, or trying to at least, and acknowledging their humanity, not asking them to qualify and prove their trauma, and just receiving it and doing our best to meet them where they are. And it's been beautiful, and I think it also illustrates how strong community is and how important and powerful it is here in Tucson.
I totally agree. That's kind of the same thing that's inspiring me lately too, is seeing how the state fails people in many ways. Like you and I have been talking a lot about recently is this Arizona Native Medicaid fraud scam that has been perpetuated actually in a lot of places across the country, but also happened in Tucson at an apartment complex here that targeted a lot of unhoused Native folks and non-Native folks too who are struggling with sobriety. And
mostly elders.
Elders. And after sort of the state, city stepped in and sort of provided inadequate relief, the relief that they could provide was like, we'll take you to other programs, but you'll have to leave Tucson.
Right. Or also, like, these are folks who were living in what was the equivalent of a small, like, apartment to some extent, and to then offer anything less than an apartment, to offer like emergency bed,
like shelter.
Literally, it is inadequate. And all of these resources, quote unquote, these alternate housing resources required people to separate from their pets, their partners, and their belongings. And I think that after trauma,
there was so much.
It is, and also to demand that people leave those things after. Trauma is cruel. It was cruel, city of Tucson.
No, yeah, and such, oh my God. Like, if such shelter was like, you can stay here if you leave your cat behind, and be like, well, it's on the street again for me.
Yeah.
Like, what's that?
No way.
Mocha never.
Would never.
Yeah, so I guess it's just, I've been heartened by community stepping in and filling in the gaps where, like, impersonal and bureaucratic and, you know, like,
processes,
needless red tape programs have let people down. You know, because it's just like people need food, even if they don't want to abandon their dog, even if they don't want to separate from their partner. And that sort of, and the reason it inspires me too is because the GOP is always talking about the border. Mm-hmm. And this invasion and how the border is overwhelmed. And the truth is that the border, the communities at the border, the ones that I know, are actually the most generous communities.
Literally. Like, honestly. They're like, the...
I didn't see mutual aid like this in the Bay Area. I mean, and granted, like, I wasn't the same political person that I am now in the Bay Area, so maybe I wasn't as tapped in, but...
No, I agree. And it exists in Nogales on both sides, in the Arizona side and and Mexico's side of Nogales, where even communities from Tucson, I know, take regular trips down who are able to cross and will bring goods and feel like if they do have that status, that it's kind of their profound responsibility to, you know, that's solidarity. Like, I will not leave you behind, my asylum seeking neighbors, my family, my, you know, cousins to some extent.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ronnie, it's always a pleasure to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much for being patient with my tech issues, and
thank you for letting me test these fancy mics with you.
This was so fun.
This is
I feel like talent. You
know. No, right? No, it feels like a full recording studio, and I'm just like talking into the mic. Like, take that again. Love it.
All right, bye, cachimonas.
Thank you for listening to Radio Cachimbona. Radio Cachimbona is an abolitionist podcast hosted and produced by Yvette Borja. The audio archives state repression and fierce migrant resistance in the southern Arizona borderlands and breaks down case law and politics from a leftist perspective. Yvette prioritizes uplifting the voices and histories of Central Americans. As a first-generation professional, his parents are Salvadoran immigrants. If you all love this episode and want to support the podcast, becoming a patron at patreon.com/radiocachimbona is the best way to do so for $3, $5, or $10 a month. You get early access to episodes like these, or exclusive access to the lit reviews, which are book club style chats. Another amazing, super, super, super helpful way to support the podcast is to leave a review and rating wherever you listen to podcasts, whether that be Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Leaving ratings and reviews really helps podcast with visibility. I really, really appreciate it. Bye, cachimbonas!